Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Cassandra Raphael, and today I'll be presenting my research on adiposity rebound as a predictor for obesity in inner city minority girls, which was a joint effort between SUNY Downstate's Department of Pediatrics and the Graduate Program in Public Health. I'll begin by discussing some obesity statistics and introducing the concept of adiposity rebound. Then I'll discuss the project's research objectives and results, and finally I'll conclude with interpretation of the findings and implications of the research project. First, however, I must disclose that there are no personal financial relationships with commercial interests relevant to this presentation that existed during the past 12 months. Today's obesity epidemic has been developing over the past 30 years, with the last 20 years showing the greatest increase in incidence. In 1990, most of the nation showed an obesity prevalence of between 10 and 14%. By 1998, that increased to 18%, and the most recent statistics show that in 2007, most of the nation has an obesity prevalence around 27%. So the prevalence has nearly tripled from 1990 to 2007, and it's still on the rise. Looking at National Health and Nutrition Examination surveys from 1976 to 2004, we observe a similar increase in incidence for child and adolescent obesity. For children aged 6 to 11 years, the prevalence increased from 6.5 to 18.8%, and for children aged 12 to 19 years, the prevalence has increased from 5 to 17.4%, again, nearly tripling in both cases. Today, over 12.5 million children, U.S. children and adolescents are overweight, and it's partially attributable to the multifactorial nature of the disease, as well as the lack of consensus for effective treatment strategies. Particularly in low-income African American and Latino urban communities, rates of overweight or obesity surpass 40% of school-aged children. For example, this NHANES graph suggests that over the past decade, the obesity prevalence in black girls has nearly doubled. And the prevalence in this population surpasses their male counterparts and age peers of different ethnicities. Therefore, black girls in an urban community being so highly obesity prone comprises the sample population of this research project. This graph also shows that obesity can begin very early in life, suggesting that we should develop effective preventive strategies for young people. One group that has been actively trying to counter the obesity epidemic is pediatricians, and many reasons have been cited to explain why pediatric providers have reported being unable to effectively address the obesity epidemic. On average, pediatricians spend 15 minutes with each patient, and only 5 of those minutes is devoted to counseling. Because there are many different and competing issues that pediatricians have to address with their patients, it's important for them to know when nutritional and behavioral counseling should be placed at the top of the priority list. In 2007, the American Academy of Pediatrics published guidelines in an attempt to direct physicians through countering the obesity epidemic. They focus on secondary prevention tactics, which are to be implemented when the child is clinically overweight, but at this time, the child is significantly more likely to attain clinical obesity, especially in very obesity-prone populations, like in urban communities of Hispanics and African Americans. Primary prevention strategies may be an early, an effective predictor of who's going to be obese before they actually obtain that initial overweight. BMI is the currently recommended way to identify children at risk of obesity. The formula for BMI is weight over height squared, and it's an important measure because it can be related to corollary effects of obesity, such as coronary heart disease. In adults, it's easier to use BMI cutoff points to categorize overweight and obesity. However, in children, BMI percentiles are more adequate for categorizing overweight and obesity because the children are still growing in height. This is the BMI chart for girls, where we can log a time trend in changing BMI beginning at age 2. On the x-axis is age, here's age, and on the y-axis are the BMI values. These curves on the graph represent how the children are growing. The middle line is a 50th percentile and represents how the average child would grow. The green arrow points to the 85th percentile, which is clinical obesity, and the red arrow points to the 95th percentile, which is, the green arrow points to the 85th percentile, which is clinical overweight, and the red arrow points to the 95th percentile, which is clinical obesity. Now let's look at the 50th percentile. We can see from age 2 down to age 5.5, the BMI is decreasing because the children are gaining relatively more height than weight, and after 6 years, age 6, there we go, the BMI is steadily increasing because the child is gaining more weight than height. Now, this trough or valley in the BMI value this year has a name. It's called the adiposity rebound, and it is after this time, after this point, that children begin to gain more weight than height. So now I'm going to get into what adiposity rebound is. This graph shows the BMI pattern in a healthy, non-overweight 9-year-old girl. The yellow flags represent the patient's BMI percentiles at each point plotted against the CDC standard. This chart is demonstrative of a normal adiposity rebound. The lowest recorded BMI is at 5 years of age, so this point is the adiposity rebound. These two are abnormal adiposity rebound patterns. On the left panel, we see early adiposity rebound. This 7-year-old girl has her adiposity rebound at age 3. The patient on the right exhibits no adiposity rebound because the lowest recorded BMI is also the youngest recorded BMI, and no adiposity rebound demonstrates a constant upward percentile crossing. Abnormal adiposity rebound may be an effective early predictor of obesity before the child becomes overweight because the child is engaging in sooner upward percentile crossing than what is expected. The goal of our study was to assess adiposity rebound as a predictor for adolescent obesity in inner-city minority girls. To fulfill this goal, we employed the following objectives. One was to determine the applicability of the standardized growth chart to a sample of minority female pediatric patients. Two was to determine the association between early or absent adiposity rebound and the likeliness of later obesity. And three was to determine at what ages an abnormal adiposity rebound is detectable. The study took place in Flatbush, Brooklyn of New York City. The picture on the right are New York City's five boroughs and where Flatbush is located relative to them. Particularly, the setting was SUNY Downstate's pediatric faculty practice, which is part of a large urban academic medical center serving a predominantly black population. In fact, 86% of the patient population of the practice is black or African American, and 11% is Hispanic. 35% of the pediatric practice's patient population is overweight and or obese. We conducted a retrospective chart review of 200 inner-city minority girls. To create our sample, we started with 6,410 patients of the practice of the pediatric faculty associates from January through May 2008. We excluded children less than 6 years of age, those who could not provide growth data dating back until age 2, and those with chronic medical problems. And we also excluded the male patients. Our final analytic sample size was 200. We performed a retrospective chart review on these pre-adolescent girls coming in for regular medical care to an inner-city academic medical center over a 10-year period. Our main outcome measure was adiposity rebound, which was visually determined using the methodology of Crokey and his colleagues. Timing of adiposity rebound was defined as the lowest BMI value surrounded by two higher BMI values, which I showed you in a previous slide. Absence of adiposity rebound was noticed when the lowest BMI value was the youngest recorded BMI value. And to fulfill the objectives, we did statistical tests in EpiInfo and SPSS. And the upcoming results section will delineate the tests employed to fulfill each objective. Okay, so after all the exclusions, we had a final analytic sample size of 200 girls. All of them were ethnic minorities, but we were not able to determine who was black from who was Hispanic. The patients were between ages 6 and 17 years. According to Haas and her colleagues' 2003 study, insurance status could be a suitable proxy for socioeconomic status and income. So therefore, with 59% of our patients being on Medicaid, approximately half of our patients were of lower socioeconomic status or low income. The first objective was to determine the applicability of the standardized growth chart to a sample of minority female pediatric patients. On this graph of Z-scores, we are comparing our sample in red versus the national, this is our sample in red versus the national standard for a normal BMI pattern, which is depicted as the x-axis here. Our patient population is not growing at the same rate as the national standard would suggest. Up until age 6 years, our population is steadily gaining more weight than height until they reach one standard deviation above the national mean, which is the 85th percentile BMI or clinical overweight, which is right here. At 8 years of age, our patient population attains its highest rate of weight for height increase. And after age 8, the change in BMI, the rate of change in BMI slows down until age 11, which is good news, but still, at age 11, when compared to the BMI standard, our population of pre-adolescent girls is still one standard deviation higher than the national mean would suggest is healthy or normal, and they are left clinically overweight. Descriptive statistics, I'm sorry. Using descriptive statistics, we were able to see what the growth pattern of our population was. So at their final doctor's visit, about 42% of our patient population was overweight or obese, 18 and 23, about 42. And 58.5% were healthy. Also, abnormal adiposity rebound was experienced in about more than half of the sample, let's just say. So more than one-third had early adiposity rebound, and about one-fifth had no adiposity rebound. Using more descriptive statistics, we constructed this graph of mean BMIs that shows the pattern in adiposity rebound in our sample population versus what is considered the standards pattern in black. So the x-axis is the age in months, and the y-axis are BMI values. Again, normally adiposity rebound takes place around age 5, around 60 age months. And in our sample, adiposity rebound, and which is the lowest point, takes place at age 3, which is considered by national standard an early adiposity rebound, which I previously showed you was something of an abnormality. The second objective was to determine if an association exists between early or absence of adiposity rebound and later likeliness of obesity. To explore this possibility, we conducted a chi-square test. And there are three things that I'd like to point out about this 3x2 table that describing the association between adiposity rebound with weight classification. First is that 83% of the girls who experienced a regular adiposity rebound were in fact at a healthy weight at their last doctor's visit, which shows consistency with the national standard. Second is that 76% of the girls who experienced no adiposity rebound were either overweight or obese at their last doctor's visit. And third was that 42% of our entire sample population was overweight or obese, which is a huge portion of our sample population. And as indicated by our chi-square and p-values, we found a statistically significant relationship between the timing of adiposity rebound and the final weight status. We then calculated odds ratios to determine the magnitude and direction of the association between adiposity rebound timing and weight classification. In our sample, girls who have no adiposity rebound are about 15 times more likely to be overweight or obese than girls who experience a regular adiposity rebound. And girls who experience an early adiposity rebound are about 4 times more likely to be overweight or obese than girls who experience a regular adiposity rebound. And again, our results are statistically significant because 1 is not included in the confidence interval. For our third objective, once we determined that early or no adiposity rebound was associated with obesity in our sample, we wanted to know at what ages this association could be observed. To do this, we conducted a student's t-test to see if there was a statistically significant difference in the mean age of adiposity rebound between girls who are overweight and obese versus those who are at a normal or healthy weight. So as you can see, overweight or obese patients experience adiposity rebound around 2 years sooner than girls who were at a normal or healthy weight. And we're 95% confident that overweight and obese girls experience adiposity rebound anywhere between 18 and 32 months sooner than girls of a normal healthy weight. Why is this important? Because timing is everything. So if we are vigilant, we can institute primary prevention tactics as soon as possible. Concerning study limitations, although we're working in a predominantly black patient population and we know the ethnic breakdown of the patient population, 86% black and about 11% Latino, we have no self-reported data on ethnicity in this sample. Also, we didn't collect any information on potential confounders, such as the child's birth weight, the mother's perinatal health and weight, the maternal fetal nutrition, and infant feeding. Such information would have enabled more complex analyses, such as multivariable regressions. And lastly, in order to generate the comparison between this national CDC standard and our sample population, we standardized the means to the overall population. In conclusion, national statistics have shown that young black girls are a very obesity-prone population. Our sample population, with 42% of our girls being overweight or obese, is not a typical U.S. population and is growing differently from the national standard. Adiposity rebound appears to be associated with obesity risk in this sample population. And girls who are overweight or obese experience adiposity rebound on average 2 years sooner than girls who are at a healthy weight. So tracking changes in BMI over time can help detect if a girl is going to be obese before she actually is overweight and as early as age 3. So in this study, adiposity rebound appeared to be a useful instrument in determining who would become obese before they were actually overweight. So what we did was a retrospective study. For increased reliability, the same study could be done in a larger sample population and prospectively. If adiposity rebound is accepted as a predictor of obesity, a study must be done seeing if clinicians can incorporate this technique into their clinical practice. And if it is accepted as a predictor of obesity, the technique should be studied for efficacy as an obesity prevention measure. And finally, I'd like to thank Dr. Eugene Dinkevich of the Department of Pediatrics and Dr. Michael Joseph of the Graduate Program in Public Health, who have been my mentors and incredibly inspirational. Thank you. And Professor Malka, who helped me interpret and realize some of my biostatistical results. Thank you very much.
So that, thank you to our final presenter. And I'll now open the floor to any questions.
They've been things like rash, redness, or soreness. A number of young women report substantial muscle pain from at the site of the injection. There have been reports of fainting, and it's not clear why people faint after the shot, but what they've implemented at this point is a wait period after that first shot, where it's given and then the young woman remains in the doctor's office for some monitoring. But beyond headache, some increase in temperature, muscle pain, stiffness, redness, rash, things like that, which are recounted repeatedly, there have not been, it has not been given long enough in the States for us to necessarily know long-term effects. However, I think it's important to realize this vaccine has been given overseas for longer than it's been given in the States, and there haven't reported events beyond what has been described so far, and much of the data that they're reporting on adverse events is based on that overseas data. It took a longer time to have the vaccine approved here than it did in other places.
Well, just to piggyback off of that, two things. Number one, can you tell us if those long-term or adverse events that we're seeing associated with HPV is any different from that which we've seen in other vaccines that we know are approved and tried, et cetera? And number two, could you also maybe talk to how this vaccination is being used in other populations, i.e. men, in other countries around the world?
Yeah, I don't know whether it's being used with men. I do know that there's been some discussion of that. But the data aren't in, and it's not strong enough for them to recommend vaccination for men. So I'm not sure where they are with that. But the side effects so far and adverse events are not that different than what you would see in ordinary vaccination. It seems to follow about the same trend and pattern.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Quiet group here. None? Okay. Oh, we do. One more. Great. Could you stand up and tell us who you are and where you're from?
Sure. My name is Janelle Bensinger, and I'm Director of Research at the Reading Hospital in Medicine in Pennsylvania. And I have a question for Cassandra regarding the adiposity rebound. And my question is surrounding the prevention strategies that you've been discussing, Dr. Dinkevich. What types of prevention strategies were you thinking about for an age group like this, given this were to pan out as an effective predictor of later overweight?
Okay. Well, particularly at Downstate in the pediatric department where I happen to do my research, we do have a program called Downstart, where a lot of the children are referred and they get an opportunity to do exercises with a professional, and they're given a lot of nutritional and behavioral counseling. So that's really what this study will be used to, you know, generate more grants in order to receive funding for this program, which has been proven pretty good for the children. Most of it still so far is behavioral and nutritional counseling. We all know that nothing has been, you know, decided as a good treatment strategy for obesity, so everything kind of relies on prevention, and this is what we're doing to generate that kind of prevention. And the children are being referred to this program, which happens to be a very good program for them. So this research kind of kind of is I've presented this research in the Department of Pediatrics, and now the physicians are kind of tailoring the way that they're following, they're tracking their patient's growth patterns and referring to the program with that information.
So would it allow that program to be accessible to children who have not yet become overweight?
Yes, and that is the point of what my study is about, is being able to identify who is going to become obese or overweight before they actually attain that by surveying patterns in their growth early.
Do you think that's, I'm sorry, but do you think that's doable without stigmatizing the children by, I guess, say a six-year-old gets entered into that program, could it be done in a such a way that not going to make that six-year-old think that there's something different about him or her, or putting some fear into his or his parents or her parents' minds?
No, I think that probably this stigma is kind of banished when you incorporate the child at an early age. The child knows that they're healthy, but because there are differences in their growth, they are kind of incorporated into this program with other children who are healthy. Some perhaps might be overweight or obese, but not all of them are. So the child doesn't see him or herself as different from anybody else, particularly then. Thank you.
My question is,
same thing. Could you? Who are you? Stand up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. So just for everybody in the back, the question was there an assessment of parental obesity and overweight rates? And if so, was there any sort of correlation or determination made about that?
Actually, no. It's a very good question. Yes, I'm sure that many studies do have an association between parental and child overweight and obesity. However, for our study, we did a retrospective study looking only at the children. As I stated in my my study limitations, those kinds, incorporating that kind of a confounder, like the parents' health and weight and obesity and overweight status, would have allowed us to do a more complex analysis. But for our study, it was retrospective, looking solely at the child's weight data. Thank you.
Good time to follow up. Does that program that you talked about that you are already implementing, does it look at parents?
Yes, they do, because as well as addressing the child, at these ages, the child, you know, to the pediatrician, they usually come in with a parent, and if we're going to incorporate the child into a program, we also allow the parent actually has to come to the program as well. So the children engage in the physical activity and the counseling portion, but the parents also have their separate, session going on with the counseling, because as Ms. Long pointed out, there are certain nutritional things that the parents need to know in order to incorporate that into their household and to make that common practice.
To my fellow Californians,
great.
You made a suggestion which I thought was excellent when you said in our neighborhood, very much so, we're seeing more and more of grocery stores. And I just wonder what kind of tactics or strategies have been used with these stores to get them to employ individuals of other ethnicities.
Well, actually, I'm sort of a rabble rouser, and I'm throwing these ideas out because it's only been in the last 12 months that this neighborhood in South Central LA lost their Ralph's store. And you talk to the African American women there, they lost their grocery store, and they don't see the three new Latino markets that have come up in the last 12 months. They don't see them at all. They've lost their grocery store.
Well, in
so
our
we,
area, what's happening is, yes, we're losing grocery stores, but I happen to live in a very upwardly middle-class neighborhood, but they're closing the stores, and the ones that are opening up are Latino-run. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of blacks in our neighborhood either. But that is the rest of us, meaning blacks and Asians and whites, are going to those grocery stores that are close to us. And I can't see them.
suggested is the Department of Public Health has some credibility with these store owners.
So getting them to go in and do that.
And let's partner.
I see what you're saying.
Thank you
for clarifying that.
Yes.
Because I knew that I would have no leverage.
No. And essentially, when I shop at the Latino markets, because I love £3 for a dollar, fresh peaches or tomatoes, or I love the prices on the grocery on the fresh produce. I'm the only Caucasian, so I'm saying let's have a partnership. Let's build that triangle between either a church or a neighborhood group, the Department of Public Health, and the grocery store, because essentially most businesses will do what is profitable.
I've got a question here and here.
Good afternoon. My name is Rose Dow. I'm a second year MPH student at Florida A&M University. And my question is for Cassandra. It deals with, I know you stated that breastfeeding was a limitation, but given your studies and given the research that you've done, do you think that the breastfeeding would actually delay the AR among this group, or would you think it have no impact at all?
Well, I think that would be a question that's better answered probably by somebody who's in an infant feeding kind of a study. Unfortunately, I haven't done an infant feeding kind of study. But, I mean, I guess that would kind of depend on how breastfeeding, perhaps that would kind of depend on how breastfeeding interferes, like how infant feeding does reflect on later growth patterns. In my study, if there were some kind of relationship between breastfeeding and perhaps later overweight, I'm not sure what the comparison, what the association would be, then perhaps early adiposity rebound or no adiposity rebound could be related to breastfeeding.
Oh, and I want to address that. I'm working on improving breastfeeding rates, which, as you know, are the lowest in among African American women. And one of the travesties of justice is how the formula companies get into the hospitals. Only 27% of our mothers of any race or ethnicity are exclusively breastfeeding when they leave the hospital. And how long do you stay in the hospital with a new baby?
2 days.
2 days. And only 27% are exclusively breastfeeding. And there is a relationship to the incidence of overweight and obesity. If you breastfeed, you cut down the probability of overweight or obesity, and it improves your rates of healthy weight by every day that you prolong your breastfeeding. So go for 6 months of exclusive breastfeeding, and go up to a year of intermittent breastfeeding. Please help. Let's make that happen.
And then two.
I do not know of any deaths associated with the vaccine. That's first. The recommendation is primarily 11 to 12 year olds, but young women as young as 9 can be given the vaccine. There has been a lot of discussion about why college age women are getting the vaccine. Some of it is because of the way the guidelines came out, and people have talked about women in that age group obtaining catch-up vaccine. My discussions with some of the vaccine researchers has suggested that is not what they intended, and that's not what they support. However, that is happening. It may allow for the opportunity to understand whether or not there is some protection afforded women who take the vaccine after they have possibly been exposed to HPV virus, or if they actually have a I can't remember which one it is. If they don't have one of the cervical cancer strains of the virus, but they have some other, it may afford them some protection. For that group being vaccinated, we may be able to find that out. It is not entirely clear why they went with that catch-up into the 20-year-old group, which they are allowing, but that was not what they intended from my understanding.
Just to piggyback off of that quickly, for anybody who wants more information on the HPV vaccination, I actually work in HIV vaccines at NIH, and we've done a lot of looking at the HPV vaccination because in our clinical trials, we want the same thing. We want healthy volunteers to be in these studies and motivations, and of course, women of color and people of color in particular are least likely to participate in our studies. So one really great resource is obviously the CDC website. You can actually go to cdc.gov, do a search for HPV, HPV vaccination, and there's a repository of information, including studies that are international studies, that are US-based studies, that are the pharma-based studies, and it'll give you a wealth of information. And to piggyback off of why they are targeting that college age range is because although there is a huge incidence of sexual activity 14 to 17-year-olds, there's also a great number of young women where their first actual sexual experience is in college. And so if the colleges are affording it, not likely for free, if they're working with Planned Parenthood where they can get it for free, you know, of course the goal is you vaccinate before somebody gets sick. And someone can be sexually active and not have been exposed. So if that's a group of people that have not been exposed and you have an opportunity to vaccinate, then they're a captive audience because they're there on that campus. So that's just speaking anecdotally about some of the stuff that I've worked on, but definitely check out the CDC website, because if any of you have known somebody who's had cervical cancer or died from cervical cancer, when there's a vaccination that can prevent it from happening, it might be something for us all to really think about. You know, if you could get a vaccine to stop lung cancer, if you could get a vaccine to stop, you know, breast cancer, would we do it? Or are we so hung up on this issue of sex and sexuality and being sexual beings? So just check out the CDC website, and that's speaking as Diane, no affiliation with NIH or Black Caucus, et cetera. Just put that disclosure out there. Well, again, that's why I really strongly encourage people to go check out the CDC website. The fact sheets are very clear. There's a lot of supporting information. And if, you know, there's been a lot of, again, working in vaccines, there's a huge upsurge right now about no vaccination and concerns about autism and all this sort of stuff. And we need to remember, though, that vaccinations are designed to prevent illness, and none of us have been afflicted with polio. None of us have had to deal with smallpox. None of us have had to deal with whooping cough because of the herd perspective and vaccinating. You vaccinate the population. So for those people who have concerns, they're completely legitimate, but inform yourself with all of the things that we've talked about today. Get the information, don't just Google it. Go to a reputable web source, go to CDC, go to NIH, go to WebMD, go to some of the colleges and universities where they might be doing research on these things. You know, find out who the experts are in PubMed, go to the National Library of Medicine. Inform yourself so that you can make a decision that makes sense, not a decision that's based in fear or not a decision that's based on somebody that, you know, Pookie told you. I mean, be informed and make a decision that's right for you because you have the adequate, proper, scientifically reviewed, peered, blah, blah, blah information.
And I want to just say, we are not trying to convince people to get the vaccine. Our concern has been the fact that people don't know and that there are a lot of misconceptions
right
out there. We just want to make sure that if people decide not to vaccinate, it is because they have the correct information and they have decided it's not worth it.
There was a question here.
My name is Kayla Hudson. I'm a second year education at Charleston University. And my question is for Dr. Lawrence.
very, very popular, especially in, you know, promoting loving yourself at the size that you are. So, you know, how do we strike that balance?
Very good question, mm-hmm. And you're on the right track. Essentially, we need to promote a healthy lifestyle. We need to promote half the plate being filled with vegetables. We need good fats in our diet, and we need to exercise at least 30 minutes every day. And then once all the women are doing that, they will get the health that you're looking for. You're not looking for a weight loss. You're looking for health. That's the reason why the brochure is Steps to a Healthy Life. And like I said, the big problem is exercise. And you just need to decide. You need to know what, and there are 10 things that you can do to have that healthy lifestyle as far as your weight, that promote a healthy weight. And just make sure you're doing all 10 of them. And you're on the right track. I'm glad you're an MPH student. Good.
I have another question. Piggybacking on what she said, mm-hmm. It would be really interesting in the focus groups to see what the African American women perceive health to be. Because if they perceive health to be losing weight, getting a size 6, then maybe we shouldn't promote being healthy. Maybe we should promote better lifestyle, using different play on words if that's what they're, you know, associating with. So I think that'd be something interesting to look at their focus groups.
Well, we actually. That's how we begin our focus groups always. You know, how do you define health? And health is defined by these women as including a spiritual component, family life and relationships. And it isn't. Essentially, what we found was you don't talk about health, your weight. You don't talk about the BMI. You talk about, are you exercising 30 minutes every day? How are you eating? And why not?
Do we have any other questions? Okay, so before I wrap this up, just want to remind you, first of all, thank our panelists for a really interesting afternoon. We appreciate all of you coming here. Just a couple of quick housekeeping things. Number one, again, this session, among others, was sponsored by the Black Caucus of Health Workers. We are the oldest and the first caucus affiliated with the American Public Health Association. We want to strongly encourage our young students, our new members of APHA, to become members of the Black Caucus if these are issues that are exciting and important to you. Go visit our booth 2219 over in the expo. And especially for our students and our younger professionals, we actively and strongly encourage you to submit your research. The call for abstracts will come out probably before Christmas. There's usually, you have until about the middle of February to submit your abstract online through the APHA online process. And, you know, we need to hear from the new researchers. We need to know what's new and exciting and what people are working on. So I strongly encourage you to submit your abstracts through BCHW or another caucus section, SPIG section, what have you, and be involved in the process, because the scientific program is based on what you all are doing and what you all want to hear. So that's the first thing. The second thing, again, this is our 40th anniversary. Our annual Poindexter Awards dinner will be tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. The awardee this year is Dr. Georges Benjamin, who is the executive director for APHA. Tickets can be purchased upstairs, actually over in the convention hall at on-site registration. They are $77. Unfortunately, we do not have a student rate. But just so you know, for next year, you can purchase your ticket with your online registration. And once again, thank you all for coming, and we hope to see you at some of our other sessions over the course of the next few days.